Life as a Nephrology Professional podcast is excited to share a recorded webinar with our listeners. In this webinar, the NKF and National MOTEP, Minority Organ Tissue Transplant Education Program, teamed up to provide education on the importance of building trustworthiness and community partnerships to advance kidney health equity and increase access to transplants for all. We hope you enjoy their panel discussion.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tangela Purnell. I'm an associate professor at Johns Hopkins University and also a member of the board for National MOTEP. It is indeed an honor and a pleasure to welcome you to our joint National Kidney Foundation and National MOTEP webinar entitled Increasing Trustworthiness and Community Engagement to Advance Transplant Equity. And we have a very exciting panel of speakers and experts in their own right, starting with Dr. Clive Callender, who is a professor of surgery at Howard University and was the founder of National MOTEP, Dr. Kirk Campbell, who is a professor of medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital and president-elect of the National Kidney Foundation, Dr. Velma Scanterbury, who is the U.S. first Black female transplant surgeon and is a board member for National MOTEP, Ms. Morgan Reed, who is a kidney transplant recipient, as well as the director of transplant policy and strategy for the National Kidney Foundation. And rounding us off is Mr. Kareem Ali, who is an organ donation advocate, as well as chief relationship officer with the Muslim Life Planning Network. And so again, we welcome you and we look forward to an engaging conversation. But at this time, I would like to welcome Dr. Callender, who will give us some opening remarks.
Thank you very much, Tangela. You know, I was thinking of the fact that in February of 2022, the National Academies of Science and Engineering and Medicine proclaimed that the organ transplant system was demonstrably inequitable. And it made me think of the way in which we've been working towards equity. We kind of started off nationally in 1991. When we conceptualized MOTEP, the National Minority Organ Tissue Transplant Education Program. And between 1993 and 2010, MOTEP received $16 million from the National Institutes of Health and then created 20 MOTEP sites in order to reduce the incidence of end-stage renal disease and also to increase organ donation rates, because at that time, 22 people were dying daily because of the shortage of donors. We therefore went into the community to educate and empower them to love themselves, take care of themselves, and thereby decrease the incidence of end-stage renal disease. And secondly, to get them to go from awareness to action to accountability, the AAA effect. Interestingly enough, between 1993 and 2010, the number of minorities who donated doubled. The number of Blacks who donated tripled. This was just a small step towards equity, but it reminded me of the fact that we therefore did testify before the National Academies to try to tell them about some of the ways in which transplant equity might be accomplished. What we did recognize and notice was that there's a relatively small number of people of color who are on top of the transplant organizations. While we make up 59%, of the people who are waiting for transplants. And with that in mind, Dr. James Hildreth, the president of Meharry, in the fall of 2021, developed a coalition of the four HBCU medical schools and decided we needed to work together to change that paradigm by educating people of color in the medical schools, nursing schools, and in the middle schools as well, to increase the number of people of color in the organ transplant system. The HBCUs were then joined by the organ procurement organizations in this effort. And then in February 2022, NASEM, which I'll call the National Academies, declared that the organ system was demonstrably inequitable and made recommendations for changes that would have to be done by 2026 and called their program the realization of the promise of equity in the organ transplant system. And so this webinar today is planned to help us take an even bolder step as MOTEP, the National Kidney Foundation, and others work together to increase trustworthiness and community engagement all of which are necessary to further advance transplant equity for all. To this extent, we've also included the MOTEP newsletter. Our theme that we will reemphasize is we want the community to love yourself, take care of yourself, and move from awareness to action to accountability. Thank you for letting me make those introductory remarks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Callender. And of course, we also thank you for being one of the trailblazers in helping to really sound the alarm to these very stark issues of inequities in transplant, especially at a time when few were even paying attention to the topic. So thank you for your steadfastness in doing that. I will now sort of transition over to our panel discussion. And let's get started. Morgan, girl, how are you? Are you doing well?
Oh, you know, listen, it's Black History Month. I'm leaning with it. I'm rocking with it. I'm having a great time. I'm in D.C. And listen, I'm happy to be alive.
Amen. Amen. And as a transplant recipient, right, we thank God for that and thank God for you. Why is it so important to raise awareness about the issue of health equity in chronic kidney disease burden, in shared treatment decisions, and donation and access to transplant? Why should we as a community still care about this as a topic?
I think we should still care about this as a topic because people are people, we're human, right? And I think it's important that we all level the playing field so that everyone has access to high quality care. So when we're talking about chronic kidney disease, for those who may know this on the call and those who may not, we know that chronic kidney disease disproportionately affects people of color, right? We also know that we are Black people have a high prevalence of comorbidities such as hypertension and diabetes that lead to chronic kidney disease. So it's really important. People don't know what they don't know, right? So education and awareness is really important. For those who have healthcare access, we need allyship. We need people to come to the table with us, link arms with us to drive the change that we need so that we all have access to the same healthcare. But when we're talking about CKD and kidney failure, when it comes to kidney failure, Black people are 4 times more likely than our white counterparts to develop kidney failure. Dr. Callender just gave the statistic that a majority of the people on the waiting list are people of color, yet we are less likely to receive access to transplantation. Shared decision-making is something that is really important and lacking in our communities. Most people don't know the full breadth of treatment options for kidney failure, such as home dialysis, preemptive transplantation, and transplantation. Oftentimes when you ride through under-resourced areas or the hood, right, in America, you won't really see lots of grocery stores or maybe green spaces, but what you will see are dialysis centers dotted on every other corner, right? That's a problem. We deserve to live long, healthy lives too. And we shouldn't just be living the length of our lives, but we want to live the width of our lives too. So it's really important for, you know, it's funny, I just left a Black health forum where Secretary Becerra, the HHS secretary, was talking about how the administration is really focusing on health equity and how everyone in healthcare has to take a health equity lens in the approach to their work, because we know that there are so many chasms that exist in healthcare, but specifically in kidney care. So we need the allyship. And again, it's about linking arms and thinking about the ways that we can work together to close those disparity gaps, because again, it shouldn't matter what your zip code is. It should not matter your race, your ethnicity, the language that you speak. None of this should be your sexuality, your gender. Everyone deserves access to care. And when we're talking about health equity, I'm going to go rogue here and hope that I don't get my hand slapped, but we can't all lives matter health equity. This is not an all lives matter situation. There are people out there that have access and they have privilege, and there are a lot of people out there who don't. And we're trying to work together to level that playing field. And really, that's what health equity is all about.
Awesome. Thank you. There definitely won't be any hand slapping from me. So we do thank you for speaking your truth and speaking the truth. And, you know, I know that part of where I wanted to go next was to talk about factors that contribute to health disparities and kidney failure and barriers to transplant. But I want to do a bit of a pivot maybe first. And Dr. Campbell, if it's okay, to turn to you in your role as a nephrologist and maybe talk about even some of the more upstream factors. So the earlier stages of chronic kidney disease, the progression, right, to complete kidney failure. Where are we sort of, getting it wrong? What can we do better to first sort of tackle some of those disparities before we even make it to kidney failure?
Yeah, thanks so much. That's an excellent question. We know that approximately 90% of individuals with kidney disease do not know they have it, right? So it really starts off with ineffective screening approaches. We don't have a national screening program for kidney disease to begin with. So too many patients, approximately 40% of individuals have an experience where they crash into dialysis, as we call it, right? Where they show up with kidney disease that's far too advanced for us to meaningfully slow the progression, right, and reduce morbidity and mortality. So fortunately, there are medications now coming online that can effectively slow the progression of kidney disease, especially among patients with the protein spilling disorders and diabetic kidney disease. But we're not doing a good enough job of implementing, right, those agents to the communities that really need them, as Morgan alluded to. You know, getting the right treatment options to patients who really need them is something we have to really tackle from a public health standpoint. So all the barriers where we talk about access to appropriate care and healthy foods and, healthy lifestyles and appropriate insurance coverage and transportation, these things all impact, right, what we can do from the clinical standpoint. So we really are in it together to identify patients early enough where we can make a meaningful difference, right, to slow the progression of disease to the point where they don't need a kidney transplant or dialysis. That's what we really want, right? We see transplant certainly as the best option when we have no other options, right, when kidney disease is far too advanced, but we'd much prefer to have a bigger impact much earlier upstream.
Thank you so much. And along those lines, right, so now we're continuing down this spectrum of illness. And unfortunately, we know that there are many people who we didn't catch in time, we didn't help to slow the progression, who ultimately will end up with complete chronic and permanent kidney failure and will be in need, right, of life-sustaining treatments. And so, Dr. Scantlebury, from your perspective as both a transplant surgeon and as one who provides care to the broader community, one, we first want to thank you for all of the doors, right, that your career and your story has helped to open for so many. And for those of you who will take the time to even look at this month's MOTEP newsletter, you will see how we have progressed even in the field, going from the first one of one, what's the Beyonce quote, one of one, the only one, right, Dr. Scantlebury, to now having a list of other very brilliant Black women transplant surgeons. But from this perspective of kidney failure, right, what do we know, even from a research perspective, clinical perspective, what are some of these factors that contribute to disparities in health outcomes, that contribute to disparities in treatment, as well as general access to transplant for those people who unfortunately progress to complete kidney failure?
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Purnell. Thank you for that introduction. And it is so important to understand that when we think about health disparities are preventable differences in the burden of disease that patients face. I'll focus on that word, preventable differences, because many patients, unfortunately, may not have access. And when we think about what we're trying to achieve in terms of health equity, the definition of health equity is the state in which everyone has a fair and just opportunity to attain the highest level of health, which means that you have to be able to see that patient as an individual patient, see their needs, understand that what they come with, depending on the social conditions of where they live, where they're born, where they work, they may have lack of resources. And so those resources will lead to difference in their outcomes. And so when you think about kidney transplant patients or those who want to are considering transplant, they often will have many factors that we now say, okay, there may be barriers that exist. And those barriers are now referred to as the social determinants of health. So when you think about a patient who is now coming to the transplant process, understanding, as Morgan touched on earlier, not understanding the choices, not giving them information to even understand what is the difference in terms of dialysis versus getting on the transplant list. And what are the advantages of that? Even and then we have the subjective part of the referral process where they may be, the healthcare professionals may see patients as not suitable for transplantation, and that bias that goes into those referrals. So you have patients who may sit on dialysis for years not knowing that that is an option, and being told incorrect information, or maybe they're not hearing it the way, maybe the information is not delivered in a way that they can comprehend it. So we know that there are language barriers, there are health literacy in terms of what maybe, you know, we always say have the patient repeat what you say, but sometimes the physician, the caretaker, that message is not delivered in a positive way to encourage that patient to even want to consider transplantation. And so that is vital. Many patients, when they get to dialysis, may have economic issues in terms of affording to be even not even understanding the transplant process, and that it may be covered by Medicare, and thinking, well, you know, I can't afford to go have all these tests. So information is key. It's really looking at how can we eliminate the barriers that when that patient comes to the transplant center, we're beginning to say, okay, this is, rather than dismissing the patient or saying, okay, as many patients will say, oh, you know, I got there and evaluated and told me to come back after I lose 50 pounds. Well, it may be impossible for that person to lose 50 pounds. How are you going to help that patient achieve that goal? What are you going to do to help them eliminate that barrier? So it's about understanding the patient, seeing them where they are, identifying what it is. Is it the referral process? We know that when we look at the literature, African-Americans and people of color take longer to navigate the way they go through the whole workup process. Maybe they need help with getting from appointment to appointment. Maybe transportation is an issue. So it's really upon the transplant centers, and rather than say this patient is not compliant, maybe it's what can I do to facilitate getting this patient to the goal line? Not blaming the patient because they have chronic kidney disease, but understanding that where they look, they may not be able to get on the bus route. They may not be able to, maybe they have to take 4 buses to get to this transplant center. They can't afford a toll depending on where they're coming from in the rural area. So it's being able to turn the lens on and have that empathy to be able to say, I may live in a different circumstance, but let me just identify, if you don't know what the social determinants of health are, familiarize yourself with the various barriers that would limit patients to getting on the list, understanding their choices, understanding how you can help. And we talked about allyship, having that allyship to be able to bring your staff in. We know many states have Department of Public Health that really have resources that will help patients navigate the process. So I'm like Morgan, I could talk on and on. So I'm going to end here and pass this on to someone else. Thank you so much.
You know, everyone, right? It feels like we're in church today, right? And I think that that is a perfect transition to bringing in our next panelist, Mr. Kareem Ali, when we're talking about, right, the topic of transplant and organ donation. This is one of those unique fields where we know that religion and faith and spirituality also play really important roles. And so I recognize, right, that one of the things that we often do sometimes from the policy side or the research side is look at communities as one big monolith, right? All Black people fall under the same umbrella, all, you know, et cetera, white people, all, you know, whatever, these labels, which in many ways do not truly capture the nuances of the importance of the communities within communities. And in this case, the important recognition of the role of faith and religion. And so I would like to invite you on behalf of the work that you're doing with the Muslim Life Planning Network to talk about, are there unique barriers or concerns, right, about organ donation and transplant within those who are considered members of the Muslim community? And what strategies have you all used to help to overcome these barriers?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. You know, I would start out by saying that I believe that it is some of these issues actually transcend religion, although people's understanding of their faith actually are drivers of their behavior. So you cannot step over that. So we have found that there are some particularly unique challenges within our community that as well dovetail with what we see in the Christian faith or in the Jewish faith. And so although there are some unique things, there are some things that are aligned. So our approach actually can be fairly universal and apply to this human challenge, human dynamic. And as I say, there are challenges on the professional medical clinical side, as well as on the community side. On the professional medical clinical side, the lack of understanding of the Islamic faith in many instances would have it that these teams are really hesitant to really engage with Muslims or people who are known Muslims around this conversation around organ donation. There's a thought that they're going to be against authorization because it's against their religion, or they believe that it's against their religion. On the community side, what we see is, quite frankly, and don't mean to be pejorative here, but there's apathy within the Muslim community. Given the fact that, you know, over the years that we've been in this space, having these conversations, we asked the simple question, if you were in a situation where you needed an organ transplant, you know, would you accept an organ? And I would have to say 7-8 times out of 10, people say, yes, I would take the organ. I would do the transplant. And then the other side of it is, well, are you a registered organ donor? And they're like, well, no, I'm not. And so you've got to really wonder, like, well, where's the disconnect there? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And so we've been doing that work, right? And so what we've come to is there are a lot of needs. There are a lot of needs right now that fill the space. Helping people, so we can tell people things all day long, but that doesn't mean that it lands in a way that it becomes a part of who they are and a part of you know, what they're open to taking action around, right? What they're open to or taking a commitment to do. However, when we listen in a different type of a way, right, we can help individuals come to the understanding of the why. I believe that the why is so important in terms of organ transplant donation. The why, understanding why it is your responsibility, you know, as an individual to be a part of this effort to help preserve life. And we have to do the work to create the stories, right, that really create in people's minds the understanding as to how they fit into this puzzle. So you have trust factors that exist within the Muslim community, which is a universal challenge. You have a lot of fear, lack of understanding of the process, misconceptions regarding its permissibility, and our ability as professionals in the space to even measure how our efforts are taking root. And so we could talk about strategies, but I don't want to go too far, because like everyone said before me, we can continue to on talk, and we want to be concise with what our sharing is. But I do believe that that's such a big thing, helping create narratives, create the stories in people's minds. The stories are the ways that people make sense of the world, right? And so if we're able to help people come to why this is important for me to be actionable around, I believe we're gonna see a big difference in the attitudes, right? And it'll become table talk conversations you know, within the home, which right now, they're probably not. And so addressing the trust factors, addressing the fear, through the awareness and education. I like what Dr. Callender says, and I like what's inside the mission of MOTEP is to go from action. We'll go from awareness to action, right? And accountability. So that's sort of a big construct in terms of effective strategies, but we can talk more about it, you know, as we go forward.
Tangela, can I jump in for 2 seconds?
Yes.
Okay. I just like piggybacking off of what Kareem just said, this, I don't think we can underestimate the importance of cultural congruence and racial concordance. I see that I have some of my OPO and transplant center and government friends on the call. And I think what you were saying, Kareem, is really important. If you have, if you're an OPO or a transplant center and you know that you have a large Muslim population, it may be a good idea to link arms with the Muslim community, faith leaders, so that, and you know, not even to hire them on staff, but to have relationships and rapport with them, so that when you are engaging with potential donor families, now you have a resource that you can talk to, that you can maybe involve in that conversation when you're asking families about donation, or when you're having community fairs and you're trying to dispel the myths and misconceptions that so many people believe about organ donation and transplant. So again, I just don't think that we can underestimate the importance of cultural congruence and really again, it's about partnering and linking arms with the people that can help affect change. So I just had to throw that in there.
Thank you. And, you know, it is so important to think about our own, right, our own sort of stereotypes that we make or myths and misconceptions we may believe using historical data. For example, you know, I see sometimes people citing data from the early 90s. And as much as we all want to not believe it, the early 90s was 30 years ago, you know, so we have to really think about who are the community leaders now, who sort of has the boots on the grounds right now, and what do we need to know, right? Even as profession, as members of this profession, to move forward in a healthy dialogue and also an informed dialogue. And along those lines, right, we are now finally, I think, nationally talking about the importance of community trust and patient trust and family trust in, you know, not only this field, but in the broader fields of medicine, surgery, et cetera. I'm looking at you, Dr. Callender, because, you know, some folks have been saying this since the early 90s, that people aren't just inherently born who make decisions about life-saving measures and, you know, are just born as babies and say, oh, no way, I'm never going to donate, right? It's really rooted in life experiences, interactions with the health profession, but also, right, the general sentiment of trust within the community. So, Dr. Callender, would you mind sharing with us what are some ways that members of this profession can help to demonstrate their own trustworthiness, right? Because we often talk about community trust as if it's something that's automatically owed to us, right? But we know that it has to be earned through a demonstration of trustworthiness. So from your experience, Dr. Callender, what are some important tips to keep in mind in how to demonstrate trustworthiness within diverse communities?
One of the things that we learned as we recognized that community education and empowerment was the key to success was that kind of one of the things that Velma referred to is that the importance of lifestyle. Love yourself, take care of yourself. That's one of the most important MOTEP themes. But to prevent the need, as Dr. Campbell had mentioned, that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so getting people to adopt healthy lifestyles, to drink a lot of water, to exercise 150 minutes every week, to have a healthy weight. Those are the things that really make a difference. So if those who would like to help, go to the community, educate and empower them so they can adopt healthy lifestyles and prevent the need in the first place. And then the second part of it is going into the community, educating and empowering them to go, move away from awareness, go towards behavioral change, go from awareness to action to accountability. And those are the two themes, the two MOTEP themes that have helped us be successful in the community. Because as Morgan Reed had mentioned, Karim Ali had mentioned, it's important to have the stories that demonstrate that you care and you want to listen and you want to trust. And I think those are the two themes that have helped us become successful in getting an engaging trust. Going into social networks is very good, but nothing beats the one-on-one interaction to show that you care and that you are willing to listen. And so the recommendation is that those who want to help go into the community and educate and empower.
I love it. Walk the walk, right? Not just talking, but be about it. Absolutely. And, you know, along those lines, for those who are sort of new to, you know, this is their first time in trying to think about working with community partners or, you know, working more closely with members of communities who, you know, express fear or concerns about engaging with the medical community. We often hear, I don't want to be engaged in this process because if something happens to me, I don't want to be mistreated, et cetera. Briefly going back to you, Karim, are there, you know, tips to those in the profession as well who may be new to this that you all found were kind of really effective when trying to really get started walking hand in hand with community members?
Well, yeah, a number of things. Thank you for that question. There are a number of things that come to mind. Well, the work that we did in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area It started back in 2014. It was Washington Regional Transplant Community, which OPO, which is now joined with another Maryland-based OPO. Our goal was to work with MOSCHA communities, MOS communities, right? And so setting up information tables, being involved in their Friday sermons, providing invitations, to cultural events was very important for the community to actually see the OPO involved in their community in that way. And so now fast forward to where we are today, you know, the community, they actually come to us and ask, they want more information. They want to learn more about it. They're not at the place where it's just commonplace to sign up as a donor, an organ, donor. However, you know, and we've been asked, can you come and address, this Muslim group, that Muslim group? And I believe that that's, are going to take hold nationally, with increased efforts. Something else I wanted to share with you, and something about Muslims and Muslim community that is, I believe, universal, regardless of, which faith tradition within Islam, you adhere to. There's a concept called sadaqa jariya. It's an Arabic word that means perpetual gift. The fact that the Fifth Council of North America has now deemed organ transplantation, as permissible, well, they rendered an opinion as such, and has as well said that this is a form of a perpetual gift, is a huge driver for Muslims. Once they understand more about the process, in terms of how you're going to treat the body. And what we found is that there are a lot of challenges that occur within the process, of treating the body, having the organs, taken from the body and then having the body ready for burial. Now, we can work out these challenges between, the organizations, that, are handling people's loved ones in such a way that it's in compliance with what Muslims are comfortable with. I think you're going to find that you're going to have more, you're going to find that we're more and more aligned as community partners in this effort. So that's it. That sadaqa jariya, perpetual gift, is huge for Muslims, because we want to, there's only a few things in our faith that we believe renders a continual gift after we leave this life. And doing that is one of them. And so understanding that story from the Muslim perspective, and then creating narratives that imbue that becomes an effective strategy.
Wonderful, thank you so much. And I'm looking at, believe it or not, we have less than 10 minutes left for this moderated discussion. And at this time, I wanted to pause and invite members of the audience to begin to submit your questions for the live Q&A portion. And I do see that we have one or two questions already in the Q&A box, but please continue to submit your questions so that when we transition over, we'll have them ready. And we also thank each of you for attending. I would like to give a special shout out and recognition to Dr. Sylvia Rosas, who is the president of the NKF. So thank you so much, Sylvia, for being here and for always being so supportive of these efforts to advance health equity in both kidney health and transplantation. And we know, right, sort of transitioning back to the conversation, Dr. Scantlebury, that living donation is also an important part of our efforts to advance transplant equity. But unfortunately, for those of us who have been looking at some of the national data, we, have pretty much been able to see and recognize that rates of living donation have sort of not really been going in the direction that we hope. So what are, some tips for people or members of the audience who might be considering donation? What's important in terms of thinking about folks who might want to make that phone call to a transplant center to get that process started? What are some strategies that might be impactful?
Well, thank you so much. A lot of it boils down to, as Mr. Ali said, you have to understand or want to know more about the process. Oftentimes for our people, we have these misconceptions about what it is about living donation, just donation in general, that they might have heard from other people, generations, and not really having understanding that the benefit of living donation, you know, the whole, even in terms of deceased donation, not wanting to give things up, whether they're alive or dead, but understanding the process and being able to say, okay, I want to learn more about it. So education is key. And it's also about on the provider side, it's really about delivering that message that will carry an element of trust that you as the provider are going to do what's in the best interest of that patient and their loved one. They want to know, they need that right information. So you as a provider have to sit down and be able to have that candid discussion so that they understand that this process may involve multiple people being coming through for evaluation. They may not work out, but also the fear that they may have, well, I don't want anything to happen to my loved one. Having that discussion about this is what it involves. We're here to take care of them. We're here to make sure that if there's any underlying illnesses or even borderline diabetes, that we're not going to use their loved one, especially when we think about the for us as African Americans, the predominant diseases of diabetes and high blood pressure, they may have loved ones who may have those conditions. But it's also important to know that they may have one, their loved one may not have those conditions. So don't make that assumption. And that evaluation process is going to be probably the most thorough exam you've ever had so that we can decide whether you are a suitable donor or not. And so many families are also concerned about cost, knowing that there's no out-of-pocket cost for you as the recipient and for the donor, that those costs are covered by Medicare. And when it comes to living expenses or other things, that there may be donor assistance programs out there to help assist the donor, even in terms of the transportation, but being able to be put up in a hotel. And so it's one, getting the right information, talking with the right people to alleviate those fears that you may have. And oftentimes just something simple as, you know, mentoring, you know, connect that patient with a previous living donor recipient or a previous donor who may be able to speak to the potential donor, speak to the potential recipient, so they have a clearer idea from someone, a lay person, so that they can understand the process and be able to have that trust in the process. And that is so crucial, that oftentimes as providers, we come across very intimidating to the patients, and they may not understand what it is you're trying to convey, but you want them as they leave that room to be able to say, okay, I'm willing to do this. I'm willing to learn more about it. Or they take this home educational material, whether it's in written form, videos, so that they can digest the information over time. So I think those are key. Thank you so much.
Thank you so very much. And so the final part of our sort of moderated panel discussion is about exactly what Dr. Callender mentioned earlier, moving from awareness to action, right? But before we do this, because I would actually like for us to end with those action steps. And I look like we have about 15 questions so far. Let's see how many of these we might be able to just quickly run through within the next 5 minutes or so, 30 seconds or less. And it's a free for all, whichever panelist feels compelled to answer it first. And we'll just do one panelist per question. So the first question, how can you empower a person to do behavioral changes when the person doesn't have the time because they need to work 10 to 12 hours per day or don't have money for the basics to live? So would anyone like to sort of speak on that conundrum of trying to survive, right? But also trying to survive in a different way in remaining healthy.
Well, many of the behavioral changes don't require a cost. Exercising doesn't require a cost. Selecting the right food to eat doesn't require a cost. Drinking water doesn't require a cost. However, there are factors, as you mentioned, that do require cost. And I think Dr. Scannerberry talked about the social determinants of health. And I think that requires the sensitivity of the healthcare providers so they can support and assist them in their needs in that direction.
Thank you, Dr. Callender. Our next question, is there an online resource where we can locate, share some of the information that was shared here? And I'll answer that by saying that there will be a follow-up email. And within that email, I know we plan to include links to resources on behalf of both the National Kidney Foundation and National MOTEP as well. So the answer will be yes, we will be sharing some of these resources. Thank you for the question. The next question, I'm seeing more dialysis facilities maybe with empty walls and no information about organ donation. I'm a kidney transplant recipient. What steps can I take to get action for putting information within, I believe, dialysis facilities about transplantation? So I believe this may be a regulatory question and or a call to action question.
Well, you know, one of the things transplant recipients can do, which they tend not to do, is go to dialysis units and show them what a successful transplant recipient looks like. This, you know, the narrative is really important. And what that transplant recipient demonstrates by going to a dialysis unit and educating them is so important, because most often all they see in the transplant in the dialysis unit are people who failed transplants, not people who've been successfully transplanted.
Absolutely. Another question, if the doctor has not referred the patient for transplant, what can the patient do?
Refer themselves.
Okay. So the patient can show up to the transplant center or call to begin.
Yes. A lot of transplants. And I'll just really quickly, sorry, Kirk, I'll just share my own personal experience. I listed at one transplant center first, and I did not like how I was being treated. And the people that were stepping up to make phone calls to test to becoming a living donor, those phone calls were never returned. And so I called another transplant center myself as the patient and referred myself. So I would empower people to, if you have that knowledge, right? Because you can't empower people without them having the knowledge first. But hopefully with the people on this call we're sharing, you can advocate for yourself and refer yourself to many transplant centers. Sorry, Kirk.
Yep. No, that's fine. I totally agree. And I think, you know, we do have to mention as well that many of us remember the time where patients did not accrue time from the start of dialysis, right, on a transplant wait list. And that was an important policy win a decade ago, right, that really, you know, was an advancement in ensuring that patients would get credit on a transplant wait list from the time of starting dialysis, not waiting for a referral, because we knew that there were a lot of disparities, right, with respect to referrals that still endure.
Absolutely. And it's crazy to think that that's been a decade already as well. So time absolutely flies, just like it did during this webinar. Another question, what is the appropriate amount of time to get testing done for transplant tasks to be completed in order to get listed? So this appears to be a question around the evaluation process. So I know, you know, the short answer in general is that it depends upon the patient's situation and whether additional tests need to be made. But, you know, perhaps Dr. Scannerberry, this might be a good one for you, or Dr. Callender, are there, you know, what is sort of considered to be too long in between tasks, or what is sort of considered to be, I guess, an average amount of time that people should expect to get these steps completed?
I know most programs are made to have a timeline. It's often the goal is for patients, if they don't have a whole lot of tests, they should be able to complete those tests within 3 months, 6 months at the best. But if you come to the transplant evaluation and have been keeping up with your health maintenance issues, then it may not take that long. And you've completed your, say you're over a certain age and you've had your mammogram and your colonoscopy, and you just need to see the dentist and maybe a heart test. Those things can be done generally within that first 3 months in terms of getting appointments. The biggest thing is getting your appointment to see those providers. But if you need a colonoscopy to get listed and you have to wait 6 months, then it's going to take you longer to do that. So it's really about keeping up with the things that are needed so that when you get there, you only have the minimum amount of stuff that needs to be done. Certainly there's things that may come up that's so such that you may need further cardiac testing. And it may take a while to get your dental clearance, but I would say 3 to 6 months should be more than adequate.
Thank you so much. And we have two additional sort of question comments that I think may be as follow-up to an earlier question, where there are two attendees who commented, one saying we should have more transplant doctors who visit dialysis facilities regularly to introduce themselves and answer questions about transplantation. I don't see this happening as much now. It would be great to have doctors do this again. Followed by an additional question. I am a dialysis social worker and a living donor, and we have had transplant recipients come and speak to our patients for lobby days, and it sparked much interest. I do this twice a year in my clinic. So again, calls to action, ways that we can really, again, work together to move from awareness to action. Let me jump around. We got about two more minutes for this. And it looks like the list isn't going down. It just keeps growing. Is the recommended GFR calculation tool, CKD Epi, shown to be fair for people of color when it comes to being on the wait list for transplant? Dr. Campbell, I'm going to throw this one your way.
So, you know, again, we have to just acknowledge that it's an estimate, right, of kidney function. It's not a measured value. So, you know, by its very nature, that estimate has some shortcomings, and the science is continuing to advance to develop better estimates and better ways of measuring kidney function that are more accurate, right? So, you know, I think, you know, we can sort of use that as a data point, but facilities do have the ability to get a more accurate measurement. I think removal of the race correction was an important step, but it's not the final step, right? The journey will continue, and we're going to always strive to do better in getting accurate measures of kidney function going forward.
Absolutely. A couple more sort of comments. Greetings. I'm a certified transplant social worker. Thank you for speaking on the social determinants of health. These should not be the core reason why someone doesn't get a transplant, but I think, you know, we recognize that they are. And I spent 15 years working with dialysis patients, and it breaks my heart when social determinants of health cause them to miss out on better healthcare options. Absolutely. And we share that sentiment. Let's see. I saw another one. It's moving. Okay, one for you, Morgan. Ms. Reed, as a transplant recipient, what can you tell a patient who is skeptical to get transplanted because of the side effects of immunosuppressant medications?
I will take those immunosuppressant drugs every day if it means I don't have to be on dialysis. And really, that's kind of the short and the long of it. There are some side effects. But I, you know, we just roll with it. I would much rather have my transplant and take, you know, the immunosuppressant drugs than have to tether to a dialysis machine every night. I did peritoneal dialysis, and I did great on PD. I never developed peritonitis or anything like that. But being able to be footloose and fancy free is very important to me. So I hope that answers your question. But you can also reach out to me too. My email is morgan.reed@kidney.org, and we can talk. You know, in depth if you'd like. And that's for anyone, morgan.reed@kidney.org.
Thank you so much. And another commenter, you know, also reminded us of the importance of diet, exercise, medication, adherence, et cetera, even in the post-transplant recipient afterlife, because we want to maintain and keep the kidney or the organ as long as possible. One quick question, how accessible is kidney transplant for children under the age of 5? Any comments about trends in the pediatric population?
It is, you know, it is possible generally for kids, if they're over, if you think about the size of the kid and if they have end-stage renal disease, they're not going to be growing as well. And so generally they have to be supplemented with dialysis to get them to a certain weight to be able to fit in adult-sized kidneys, because as a transplant surgeon, most they don't give pediatric patients pediatric kidneys because of the complications. And so that depends on the size of that five-year-old. If they're 10 kilos, I'm not sure, but it's they're brought to a size that they're able to receive and be able to implant a kidney. And for because of the scarcity of pediatric kidneys, those generally the transplant program will try to help the parents with finding a living donor kidney so that they're not on dialysis for a long time. So this is where a group of young kids at that size really need a living donation, because of the very few pediatric kidneys. The match, do get extra points for match, but you have to make sure that that they fit, but it is possible.
And just a follow-up to that, if someone brings a potential living donor who's not a good match, is there a way for them to move up higher on the wait list if that person, I guess, ultimately donates to a different patient?
Well, certainly if you have a donor that's not a match, it will put you in a peer donor match system where that person will donate to someone else and they will find the suitable donor that will donate to you. If it's within the institution, if they have a large number of patients on their list, they may have their own kidney exchange program for those who do not match. And they all go into a separate category where the computer decides who matches best. And so there's actually, you actually have like a swap that occurs. They give to someone else and someone else gives to you.
Thank you so much. And then unfortunately, we're kind of out of time for the live Q&A, but I want to recognize a comment that one of our MOTEP board members, Mr. John Buchanan, made about us remembering the importance around whole blood donation and maybe thinking about any lessons that we can learn since there has been an increase perhaps in whole blood donation, maybe other lessons that we can adapt to this field. And then others, another comment in inviting patients to contact their ESRD network for additional resources and ways to get involved, and lots of other comments that we unfortunately don't have time to get to. And so I'm going to ask the NKF team who's helping us with moderating the questions, if perhaps there's a way for us to save them. And if there is bandwidth, we'll try to, you know, perhaps follow up afterwards. But I want to make sure in these last 3 minutes, right, that we get to additional action. So starting with, well, let's start with you, Dr. Campbell, in about a minute or less. And then we're going to, because we're going to end with Dr. Campbell. So let's start with you, Dr. Callender. We know that, you know, there's a lot of national policy attention in this field now, perhaps more so now than in the last at least 40 years or so. Are there some key pieces of legislation or policies or actions that National MOTEP is supporting? And is there a way for audience members to help support these efforts?
I have to give you a very short answer because you don't have much time. But I think two policies that I think are important. One is that there's a lot of interest in living donation. As you have identified in the last 10 years, the living donor list has not grown. It actually dropped over the last 10 years. And so there's efforts on the part of the National Kidney Foundation, MOTEP, and many others, such as Matthew Cooper and David Farber, who really are proposing legislation. And I think that this is a step in the right direction because living donation results in the best results and the longest results. So what we can do to increase living donation becomes important, and establishing policies and legislation is critical. Another thing that we've been involved with and often have been lone rangers along this line, along with 30,000 other patients, is to not let the OPTN, the transplant board, be run by profit organizations. We have taken a strong position that the OPTN board should be run by nonprofit, and we have taken that strong position strongly, and have written two letters to Congress to try to insist that the OPTN board remains nonprofit.
I think your dream, I think your wish came true, Dr. Callender. It is nonprofit for the board piece.
So one win already off the checklist.
Thank you.
And to final closing remarks, Dr. Campbell, we're going to turn it over to you. In addition to asking you about the initiatives that the National Kidney Foundation is supporting, ways for the audience members to help support these efforts, and then final words of wisdom as we close out our session for today.
Yeah, thanks so much. Amazing session and a lot of synergy between the great work being done by MOTEP, the distinguished panelists here, and NKF. And I really just want to direct folks to kidney.org, where you can see a lot of the initiatives that are ongoing from the NKF standpoint, legislative priorities, as well as peer support and volunteer opportunities as well. Really, kidney equity is at the center, right, of the mission for everyone at NKF. And we see the website link in the chat. You've heard a lot of discussions around going further upstream, right? Identifying patients long before they ever need kidney replacement therapy. And those initiatives are really important to advance. Living donor protection initiatives are crucially important, as we'll be modernizing the organ procurement and transplant network, right? Seeing that we get some of this valuable data, right, on referral patterns for patients and what's happening from the time of referral until, you know, patients actually get transplanted by center, right? We see a lot of transplant outcomes data, but not a lot of equity and health disparities around how long people are sort of working their way through that listing process and all the barriers that encounter along the way. So really important policy initiatives that are ongoing. On the NKF site, you'll see great programming like the Big Ask, Big Give, really, providing tips on living donation practices and, again, signing up for advocacy and peer support. We're in this together, and I think we've made a lot of progress over the last several years. This is an exciting time, and, with collective efforts and intentional action, I think we'll continue to do what needs to be done for patients who need our help the most. So thanks again for your attention.
Thank you all for being here. I thank the panelists again. And thank you, the audience members, for sticking it out with us. And, take care. And let's continue to raise awareness while we also produce action towards kidney health equity and transplant equity. Take care. Have a great day.